Okay, we're on Kapitel Chaf, Kapitel 20. We are making progress here. This Kapitel was said by David HaMelech when he sent Yoav to lead the people into battle. Now, when David HaMelech got older, he wanted to still go into battle with the troops, but the people were reluctant to send their aged and I think venerable is the word I'm looking for, king, off into battle. And they convinced him that it would be better for him to stay behind and daven for the success of the troops than to risk his own neck out on the battlefield. And as we have spoken before, David HaMelech was quite a warrior. And however, once he was convinced to stay behind, Rashi says this is the kapitel that he used to say for Yoav and the troops when they would go into battle. So it was probably put together, composed somewhere towards the end of, as David HaMelech was older. There are some, unfortunately, other than Rashi, who say it was the other way around. The people said this kapitel for David when he went into battle. But Rashi says that this is the kapitel David would say on behalf of Yoav and the troops when he sent them into battle. I mentioned that David HaMelech was quite a warrior. When he took over from Shaul HaMelech, Shaul HaMelech, as we mentioned, had been very successful in subduing the enemies of Klal Yisrael, which until that time had not been as much of a success. Since the time of Yoshua, during the entire period of the Shoftim, there were almost constant battles with their neighbors. And the Bnei Yisrael were not generally one cohesive unit. There were a lot of inter-tribe arguments, and they never were really able to control the warrings of their neighbors. Until Shmuel and Navi united the people, and Shaul HaMelech became king. And one of the things Shaul HaMelech did was subdue almost all of the enemies of Klal Yisrael. However, one that he always struggled with was the Plishtim. And it wasn't until David HaMelech that the Plishtim were finally subdued, and that Klal Yisrael had enforced peace with most of its neighbors. Now, David HaMelech fought 18 wars during the course of his Malchus. 13 wars for Klal Yisrael and 5 wars, says the Gemara, for himself. We're going to get to what that means in a minute. So he fought a total of 18 wars. And if you remember, the Psukim described that he wanted to build the base of Mikdash, and Hashem told him that his hands were too bloody from war to be able to build the base of Mikdash. Yes, Steve?
Also,
Yes. So, and I did locate the Medrash I was looking for. There is a Medrash that says that Hashem told him that if he, David, would build it, it would never be able to be destroyed. And therefore, he, David, could not build it. But the Pesukim talk only about
Why?
The fact...
What?
Because Hashem knew that in the future, Klal Yisrael would sin. If David HaMelech built the base of Mikdash, and rather than being able to take out his wrath on the base of Mikdash, he would have to take out his wrath on the people themselves. Because if David built the base of Mikdash, it wouldn't be able to be destroyed. Yes, Steve? An anger.
That was 13 wars?
13 wars for Klal Yisrael and 5 wars for himself. So now we have...
What does that mean? I'm sorry.
I'm going to get to what that means.
Okay.
I'm just tantalizing you with that, and then I'm going to get to what it means.
It seems to be working.
Part of the problem we have, and we're going to spend a little bit of time on this right now, because part of the problem we have in our particular time is we don't really know what war is like, and we don't really know what war was like. Our generation, post-World War II generation, while there have been conflicts such as Vietnam and there have been wars in Eretz Yisrael, etc., we really don't have a good view of what the Torah's idea of war is. When we read about war in the ancient times, we read about a brutality that is almost difficult to imagine. Kings willy-nilly hacking people to death, spoils of war, violence and vulgarity
brutality.
Unrestrained brutality and viciousness and cruelty beyond what we can possibly imagine.
That sounds kind of like the Middle East today.
Some things don't change very much. Sudan would have fit very nicely into the old way of doing war. Nobody would have denied. Right? It's a country that's killing a lot of its people.
And some of their refugees are actually ending up in Israel. They let about 300 refugees. And they're actually, when they come in from Egypt, they're being persecuted in Egypt. And then they come to Israel because they're Muslim. They put them in jail because they're suspicious.
So that kind of unbridled warfare, where the goal is not, the goal is just to destroy. The goal is to destroy an enemy, is certainly not the kind of warfare that the Torah has in mind. On the other hand, the kind of warfare that the Torah has in mind is not what we're used to today either. When the United States goes to war in Grenada, it's a much more civilized affair than what the Torah imagines also. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a minute. There are numerous, there are literally dozens of mitzvahs connected with war in the Torah. And most of them are connected with the king. Because the king really has two purposes. To make sure justice is done, and to wage the wars for the country. Those are really the two purposes of the king. To be the head of the physical defense forces, if you will, of the Klal Yisrael, and also to see that justice is done. Which is why we've spoken in the past. Kings have the ability to execute people that the Sanhedrin could not execute. To kill in punishment. Like, for example, if you murder somebody and Beis Din can execute you, can kill you. So there's certain requirements. For example, you have to have two witnesses. Now, what if there's a really bad murderer, Dina, but there was only one witness?
How bad can you get?
The Sanhedrin can't execute. Because the Torah says you need two witnesses. If there's only one witness. The Torah also says the person has to be warned. You know, if you do murder, that's a capital crime.
If you do murder, then someone's doing murder,
that's a crime. The Torah says that that's not called murder. That's the responsibility. Because that person, if they murder someone, then their punishment is to be killed themselves. Well, that's a different thing. However, the king... So if someone is a murderer and Sanhedrin cannot execute him, the king can. The king doesn't need the rule of court and the rule of evidence to execute someone. If he believes that someone is a threat to people, he can have him summarily executed. So one aspect of the king's job is to see that justice is done. The other aspect is to be the leader of the military and to wage wars on behalf of Klal Yisrael. So that's a significant portion of the king's job. In order to do this, let's try and picture what war is like under the Torah viewpoint, and we could sort of maybe get some sort of concept of it. First is the king can take men from the people for the army. So if he needs to raise troops, I guess it would be called, right? He can conscript, he can draft people from amongst the citizens. The army itself, when they're traveling, can commandeer fields and vineyards of the people in order to feed the army. So if we get the armies in a town and there's 300 troops and they're hungry, and let's say the pizza shop's already closed, so they can literally go to citizen X or citizen Y and they can demand, give me from your fields and your vineyards. However, they have to pay for it. And they don't actually get to take the fields and vineyards, they can take the produce from the fields and vineyards. So the army cannot come and say, this tree now belongs to the army. However, they can take the produce from that tree to eat as long as they pay you for it. Now, how does one pay for a war? A war is very expensive. So the king is allowed to levy taxes for a war. He's allowed to, there's really no restriction on the amount of taxes that a king can levy for a war. So now, in a war, when you conquer an area, there are spoils of war. The gold, the silver, the precious metals, the valuables that formerly belonged to the people who are conquered. So those spoils are allowed to be taken by the army. And the rule is that half of the spoils go to the army, and half go to the king. Now, an individual soldier is not allowed to take booty. The entire booty is collected, and it's divided up, divided up evenly amongst all the soldiers. So no soldier gets more than any other soldier. And that 50% is divided up amongst the soldiers, and 50% goes to the king personally. The king gets the first selection of what he wants. The conquered lands outside of Eretz Yisrael belong to the king personally. They are his personal property and lands, and he may do with them as he sees fit. However, there are two kinds of wars in the Torah. There's what's called a milchemes mitzvah and a milchemes reshus. A war of mitzvah and an optional war. So a mitzvah war includes anything that the Torah commands us to do. So, for example, wiping out a mullet would be a milchemes mitzvah. Conquering the seven nations that were living in Eretz Yisrael would be a milchemes mitzvah. If a nation attacks us, defending ourselves and fighting back is called a milchemes mitzvah. And there are different rules for a milchemes mitzvah than a milchemes reshus. Now, if those are the reasons for a milchemes mitzvah, why would we have a milchemes reshus? What would be the goal of a milchemes reshus? So one goal might be to expand the borders of Israel. The wider your borders are, the more safety and barrier you're putting between yourself and the enemy. What perhaps the king thinks that it would be beneficial to enhance his reputation and the army's reputation as somebody not to be messed with? We're going to go and we're going to conquer this area over here, and people will see they shouldn't mess with us. Now, milchemes mitzvah, the king can only do with the permission of the Sanhedrin. So the permission of the Sanhedrin means the king has to come and he has to explain. Imagine Nebuchadnezzar asking for permission. Imagine Ahasuerus asking for permission. The king has to come to the Sanhedrin, and he has to explain to them why he wants to do this war, and the Sanhedrin has to give him permission to do so. Now, once the Sanhedrin has given him permission, he could pursue the war with all of the taxes and troops and whatever that he wishes. But he can't do anything until the Sanhedrin gives him permission. Lands are conquered, they become part of Israel. Now what does that mean? That means they have the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. Trumas and Maisers, etc., can be a land that was formerly Goyish and now belonged to other nations, now can become ours, but only if it was conquered after we fulfilled the Torah's command of conquering all the biblical borders of Eretz Yisrael. So if the king has conquered all the land within the Torah's description of where the borders of Eretz Yisrael should be, and then he conquers additional land, that additional land becomes part of Eretz Yisrael. If he has not yet conquered all of the area, let's say he has not in the south conquered all the area the Torah describes part of Israel, but he conquers some additional territory in the north, that's not considered part of Eretz Yisrael. Because first, Eretz Yisrael has to be what the Torah defines. Then, we can add on to it. There are many, many discussions in the Gemara about various areas that were conquered at David HaMelech and whether or not they're considered part of Eretz Yisrael.
So, with Gush Katif, with Aza, what is the basis for that being part of Eretz Yisrael? That is where the Christian lived? This is where the war took place?
Yes, and also the other direction, David HaMelech conquered what would nowadays be Syria. And the Gemara determines that, for example, in Syria, that was a personal conquest for David, called Kibush Yachid, that was not part of Eretz Yisrael, and that in Syria, not that this is likely to come up for any of us soon, but if you own a farm in Syria, or you buy produce grown by Jews in Syria, you do not have to take trumas and mice.
What about the Golan
Heights? We'd have to, maybe for next week, I will photocopy the maps that show the biblical borders versus what was conquered, and we can see those areas that are in question as to whether their rights to have a status of Eretz Yisrael or not.
Because the people that lived in Gush Katif held that was part of Eretz Yisrael.
So I think that we will have to get out our map book and we'll through some of the maps. Because besides David HaMelech, there were other kings that captured territory too. So we're focusing only on David HaMelech, but there was many hundreds of years afterwards when kings would conquer and lose territory as well.
So this particular area would be from this war that we're talking about with the Philistines.
Yes. Right. Now, when you come to war, when the king comes to war, the first thing he has to do is offer the enemies a chance for a peaceful settlement. The first thing he has to do, with the exception of Ammon and Moab, which it says in the Torah you cannot offer a settlement to, you have to offer a peaceful settlement to the quote-unquote other side before you're allowed to pursue war.
Amalek is part of Ammon
and Moab. Amalek would not, you would not be allowed to offer a settlement to Amalek, correct. Now, if the people that you're fighting against agree to accept the seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach, then you're not allowed to kill anyone. But they have to accept two things. They have to accept tribute and subjugation. They have to accept that they will be following the seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach. They will be subject to taxes and laws of the Jewish government.
Can they tax at a higher rate?
Not necessarily. Now, when you're offering this settlement and you're negotiating with the enemy, one is not allowed to lie or deceive them in any way. One must be perfectly honest, and you cannot deceive. Well, you know, I've got 50,000 troops behind that hill, and if you guys don't settle, and really you've got one guy with a loud drum. You're not allowed to exaggerate or lie or deceive at all. Yes?
I remember last year we were learning in Navi that a war that they're fighting, and they made it sound, the B'nai Israel's army made it sound like they're, with blowing trumpets, like they're much more scary than it was.
Yes, once the war starts, and you're actually fighting, you could do that. But when you're trying to negotiate a peaceful settlement, you cannot deceive or lie on the other side. So you can't tell them, if you don't make a peaceful settlement, I'm going to call my 50,000 men that are over this hill. But you don't really have any men. But once the war starts, you could trick them into thinking you have 50,000 men. A lot of people talk loudly. When you lay siege to a city, you're only allowed to lay siege on three sides. So that the people who want to flee have an opportunity to flee. Because there are a lot of people that really aren't all that interested in fighting in the war. The leaders of the city said, we will never give up. We will fight till the death. Well, there might be a lot of people that really aren't all that interested in that and could be just as happy down the road in the next town. All right, so you
see this in Yerushalayim over and over again when the Christians and the Muslims were fighting over it because it was a walled city that they would surround it and then they would come in and they would just flee.
Yeah, so you have to have an open fourth side that people can flee. And you're supposed to start the siege at least 3 days before Shabbos. You're allowed to fight war on Shabbos. War is considered pekuach nefesh. However, you should start it early enough before Shabbos that if they give up and everything goes smoothly, then you won't have to be fighting on Shabbos.
Is it even a milchamas for shoes?
Yes. Because once a milchama starts, it's pekuach nefesh. So therefore, even a milchamas reshus can be fought on Shabbos. Now, that doesn't mean that one can't try in one's own camp. One could try and minimize the Chilul Shabbos, but while actually fighting the battle, then one does not have to be worried about the Chilul Shabbos because considered the Kuach Nefesh. People who die in a war are buried where they fall, and they acquire that piece of land for their grave. Now there are a number of leniencies in the camp that is in camp does not have to do. The main leniencies are they could eat what's called demai. Demai is produce from which we are not sure if maaser has been taken or not. So since we're not sure if it's been taken, as a chumra, we don't eat it. That's the halacha. However, in the army camp, they're allowed to eat that. They're also allowed to eat bread and make a bracha on bread without washing first. They're also allowed to take wood from anywhere and use it without regard to where it came from. there's no need for an Eruv Chatzeros between tents. Now, this is assuming you have a camp, and the camp is enclosed by some sort of wall or fence or something, and it makes a private domain. Nonetheless, to carry from house to house, you need what's called an Eruv Chatzeros, where you put a piece of matzah, or bread or something, and everybody has joint ownership in that. So in the army, they're exempted from that while they're in the camp. They're required to observe what at the time was considered pretty radical, and that is sanitary latrine practices. We don't need to get into the details if we don't want to here, but it would by our standards seem relatively primitive. By the standards of the time, it was radical, to say the least. Now, before the nation goes out into battle, a kohen is required to address the nation. This kohen is actually anointed with oil, and he's called the Meshuach Melchava. He encourages the army, and he asks about anyone who has one of the exemptions that the Torah mentions from going to war. For example, they've just planted a vineyard, or they've just betrothed a woman and not married her. Now, this is for a Melchames Reshus. Klal Yisrael is attacked, and it's a Melchames Mitzvah. Everybody's going. But if we listen to the Rambam's description of what the Kohen says, it's very dramatic. Right? So he tells the nation, is there any man who has planted a vineyard and has not redeemed his first crop? Let him go home so he not die in war and have another man redeem his crop. Is there any man among you who has betrothed a woman and not married her? Let him go home so that he not die in war and have another man marry her. When these individuals hear his word, they should retreat from the battlefront. Once the army has assumed battle positions and will shortly join in war, he stands on an elevated platform before the entire army, and he addresses them in Hebrew. Now remember, Hebrew was not always the spoken language of the Jews, but he addresses them in Hebrew, and this is what he says. Listen, Israel, today you are about to wage war against your enemies. Do not be faint of heart, and do not be afraid. Do not panic, and do not break ranks. Hashem, your Lord, is the one accompanying you to do battle for you against your enemies and to deliver you. So these words are spoken, the Meshuach Melchama says this, and then another Kohen, like a lower ranking Kohen, standing next to the platform, says them over in an even louder voice. Then he announces, is there any man who has built a new house, that he should go home? And finally he asks if there's any man who is afraid or faint-hearted, let him go home. Now this seems what we would think is where if you would go to Korea and you would stand on a platform during the Korean War and say, if there's anybody afraid, they can leave. Right? You'd have a very small war. Okay? In fact, maybe that's the solution to wars from now on. And I think that would apply on both sides. Right, of the war. If you say anybody who's afraid can leave, you'd be left with like two generals on each side and they could cut a deck of cards and see who would win.
I don't know. A lot of pride.
But there's a lot of, but Hashem, now when a person, so now let's see what the Rambam says. After the troops are organized with their commanders and their squads and whatever. They put a big officer with an iron axe in the rear of each section of troops. And if any person does become afraid and wants to leave, they smack him in his thighs.
What?
So that he can't leave.
Wait, I thought that they just said that they
right, but if you don't leave then, now you're staying. There's no changing your mind. Now, when the Rambam says, what does it mean, is there a man who is afraid or faint-hearted? It should mean anybody whose heart is not strong enough to stand in the throes of battle. It means that he does not have the emuna and betachin to stand in battle. Once a soldier enters the throes of battle, he should rely on Hashem in time of need. He should realize he's fighting for the sake of the oneness of Hashem's name. He should place his soul in Hashem's hand and not show fright or fear. He should not worry about his wife or children. He should wipe them from his heart, removing all thoughts but that of war. Anyone who begins to feel anxious and worried in battle and who becomes frightened violates an Isser Deraisa. As it is written, do not be afraid, do not panic, do not break ranks before them. Furthermore, he's responsible for the spilling of blood of the entire Jewish nation. If he is not brave, if he does not wage war with all of his heart and soul, it is considered as if he shed the blood of the entire people. Similarly, the Navi says, cursed be he who does God's work deceitfully. Cursed be he who withholds his sword from blood. Now, by contrast to that, anyone who fights with his entire heart, without fear, with the sole intention of sanctifying Hashem's name, may be assured that he will come to no harm, nor will evil overtake him. He will be granted a well-rooted family in Israel, and he will gather merit for himself and his children forever. He will also merit Olam Haba. As the Navi Shmuel says, God will certainly make my Lord a faithful house, for my Lord fights the wars of Hashem, and evil will not be found with you. So anybody who fights a war properly will come to no harm. And in fact, in Sefer Yehoshua, when they fought all of the wars against the seven nations, nobody got killed. There's no such thing as a casualty. How could there be a casualty? A casualty would mean that you were not fighting for the sake of Hashem. You should have gone home when they said, are there any people who don't have the emunah and betachon to stand with Hashem? Go home. Now, there was someone who was killed in a war in Sefer Yehoshua, and it was such an amazing thing that they couldn't figure out why this happened. Finally, they discovered he had taken booty against the rules. And that's why he had been allowed to be killed. But a war for Klal Yisrael is a war with Hashem. Not with Hashem. A war for Hashem on the side of Hashem. Now, once you enter the enemy territory, if there's no food available, what do? There's no kosher food. How many enemy nations do you know that have a Meal Mart takeout readily available? You are allowed to eat anything, non-kosher, treif animals, if there's no kosher food available. Now, the Torah also realizes that soldiers in battle, there's such a concept of the heat of battle. And the Torah discusses the Yifas Toar, the beautiful woman of the enemy tribe that the soldier comes upon, and he's unable to restrain himself from taking this woman for the night. If that happens, he has to marry her. He must ask her to convert. And if she will not, she lives with him for 3 months. She lives with him for 3 months before he can marry her. She has to mourn her family. And if after 12 months she still does not want to convert, then she has to accept the 7 laws of the Bnei Noach, and then she can go free. If after 12 months she will not abandon Avodah Zarah, then she would be killed like any other worshipper of Avodah Zarah, because one cannot make a treaty with a city or people that do not give up their Avodah Zarah. So if you are negotiating with the enemy and they say, well, fine, you know what, you can come here, but we're not giving up our Avodah Zarah, we're not going to live by your 7 laws, then you can't make a treaty with them. At that point, you would be required to continue to go to war. So if we put this in this, or the 7 mitzvahs B'nai Noach are no Avodah Zarah, not cursing Hashem's name, murder, incest, adultery, theft, creating a just system of courts, and not eating a limb from a living animal. Now, truth is, those don't sound like hard laws. We're used to 613 laws, so these 7, yeah, we could just like, whew, go down to 7 real easy. But for the rest of the world, these are not easy laws. Now, in our day, the live limb stuff is a little easier. But, so, not worshipping Avodah Zarah, we just took out about half the world. Not cursing Hashem, not murdering, not stealing, having a just system of courts. These are not easy things that, easy as they sound. We think of them as easy because they're so basic to our understanding of the laws of the time.
Is there a teaching that a Bodhisattva at the time existed, or is there the kind of a connection?
We do not have the Yetzer Hara for a Bodhisattva that we did in the days of the Dhamma.
You mean humanity or the Jewish people?
Jewish people. We do not have the Avodah Zarah. Perhaps we'll get into it sometime, but they dive into Hashem that he shaft the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah when they came back from Gullah's Bubble, the second base of Mikveh.
But we have
yes. Oh, but we have plenty of other Yetzer Haras. We're just chock full of Yetzer Haras. In fact, we're like way, we're overflowing. The pot's just overflowing. You know how a pot in the stove and it bubbles up like that? That's us, maybe Yetzer Haras coming out of our ears. So we can picture a war situation that is not how we understand war today. I think the best way would be a civilized, humane, merciful, and dedicated to Hashem version of old style warfare. That makes sense. It's hard to, you know, it's hard for us to even understand the idea of a king these days, let alone a king and his war. Right? I mean, the king, when he brings the troops through, he's allowed to make a road, the shortest path, wherever he needs. If that happens to be through the middle of your property, what was your property doing in the way of the king? So on the one hand, it's hard for us to imagine that absolute authority that's necessary for a strong country. But if you look around, look at our governments today, the ones that argue amongst themselves are the ones that are weak. You can't, in order to have a strong nation, you need this kind of a king. However, the Torah puts very strict boundaries on how a king conducts a war. It has to be conducted l'shem shemayim, and it can't be conducted just for the sake of the barbarity of it, or for the financial gain, or for the whatever reasons people went to war in the old days, or still go to war, and that's simply not allowed.
Can you talk about the king guarding righteousness, that's one of his jobs, but yet he can put somebody to death that the Sanhedrin might not put to death? Mm-hmm. Is that because it is expected that a king would have some measure of nevuah? Because how is it that without all the proper
the king does not
procedure that
in general
be able to carry out righteousness?
The king's job is to protect and defend the people of Israel. And a murderer is somebody who is threatening the country. The same way a person who refuses to listen to the king, why should that person be put to death? I mean, plenty of people don't listen to me every day, and nothing happens to them. Why is a king, if someone doesn't listen to him, put to death? Because the king is representing the entire nation. A person who doesn't listen to the king is lessening the power of and stature of the king, and could result in Jewish blood being shed. So the king's job is to make sure and to guarantee the safety success of the country. A murderer, as an example, who is likely to murder again, is a threat. The Sanhedrin's job is to punish murderers for their crimes. The king's job is to protect people from the actions of others. It's two separate jobs. The Sanhedrin cannot punish this person for his murder, because the Torah gives very strict rules about how you are punished for murder. However, the king's job is to protect the people from being murdered. So therefore, if this fellow is going to murder again, in the king's judgment, as the head legal officer, the head of the base, the head legal officer of the country, if his judgment, you see why it's so important to have a righteous Yerushalayim king.
Corrupt king. Isn't that easy to...
All, the entire Torah, though, is based on a king being a righteous, God-fearing individual. The entire rules of kingship are written for David and Shlomo. They're not written for Menashe or someone who would abuse such a thing. The king, I mean, the halachas of being a king, there are chapters and chapters and chapters about how God-fearing and pious this person has to be. So as the head legal officer, and the head of the military, he sees a danger. Chaim Yankel could kill people. We have to kill Chaim Yankel first. Chaim Yankel is a rodeh. We have a halach on the tie of a rodeh. If someone is coming to kill you, you kill them first. If you see Shimon trying to kill Levi, Reuven can kill Shimon. So David, a melech, or a king, could see that Chaim Yankel is a rodeh. He's going to kill some other people, and he can order Chaim Yankel killed. Beheaded, actually. So that's different than the Sanhedrin's job. The Sanhedrin is a court. The Sanhedrin punishes people for their actions. The Sanhedrin does not have the right to take up arms and go around town looking for people that might likely be murderers. But yes, it's very dependent on the king being Yirah Shamayim. An evil king could institute abuses beyond belief. And that's what the whole ancient world was, a collection of evil kings. And here comes our king, David HaMelech, with a sefer Torah in front of him and all these rules of war. The other nations thought we were insane until we, of course, won. And one of the things that the king is supposed to do in these wars is make it known to the nations that you know who has defeated you? The God of the Jews has defeated you. Hashem has defeated you. You should recognize Hashem, observe the seven mitzvahs b'nei Noah, and you can live with us in peace and harmony forever. But so the king is pursuing safety and the Sanhedrin is pursuing justice and punishment. It's two different things. Right? It's called being Don Lifnei Meshur Sadin. Now there is, I believe, a halacha that in the absence of a king, the Sanhedrin has the ability to do what the king would have done. But that's a little bit of a digression for right now. The king has the ability to what in English would be called judge extra-legally. And if he's judged to be a murderer and a danger, he can have him killed. And there is no recourse for that. I mean, the person has no appeal. There is no recourse for that. Right. So under a David and a Shlomo, that would be a very good system. Under a king of not such Yirah Shamayim, definitely a problem. Two different. Does that answer your question? It's two different ideas. The Sanhedrin doesn't go out and pursue war, and the king doesn't, you know, judge whether or not a Kohen is kosher. Everybody has their job, and the Sanhedrin's job is to judge the murderer. The king's job is to prevent murder. The king, for example, can judge multiple murderers in a day. The Sanhedrin cannot. There's laws. It says you can't judge more than X amount of capital cases in X amount of time. Because a capital case is a very serious thing. It requires a lot of effort and deliberation. Whereas the king can do it all day long if he wants. Okay. Any questions? Does that help at all paint somewhat of a picture or no? Yeah? Let's take a look at our capitol here. I forgot to bring the elephant. Okay, fine. So we'll just go until dawn. Let's take a look. Capitol Chaf, capitol 20. L'manatzeich mizmor l'David. For the computer, a song of David. Yamcha Hashem b'yom tzara. May Hashem answer you on the day of distress. Zegevcha Hashem Elokei Yaakov. And may you be fortified by the name of the God of Jacob. Why the God of Yaakov? Huh? Why?
Because he had the hardest life.
Good guess. Because Hashem sent Malachim to tell him against Esau.
Yeah.
So just like that, we want Hashem's help in our battles. Yishlach Ezrecha Mikaidish, may he dispatch your help from the Kaidish, from the, this translates here as sanctuary, Umitzio Nisodeko, and from Zion he should support you. So the sanctuary, Kodesh really means like a holy place. It's really referring to the Kodesh HaKadoshim, where the Ark was, and that which was the center, with the Beis HaMikdash was the center of the Shekhinah, and the Kodesh HaKadoshim was the center of the Beis HaMikdash. So it's saying that the Shekhinah should come out from Tzion to help you. Yizkor kol min chasecha, you should remember all your offerings, v'elasecha, yedash nesela, and your ilas, your korbans, you should accept with favor. Offering. So it would appear there were special korbanos for going to war. Special korban they would bring, asking for success in war is what it appears. Yitain lecha chavavecha, may he grant you as your heart desires, v'chol atzasecha yamale, and every plan may he fulfill. So the plan's referring to just pretty much what it sounds like, your strategies, your tactics, plans. David HaMelech, I'm sure we've mentioned before, besides being a brave warrior, was somewhat of a military strategical genius as well. In the theme of him being all things to all people, right, he was greatly respected by the military, not just for his bravery, which certainly I'm not minimizing his bravery, right? However, he was also a tactical and a military genius as well. Pasuk says, Nuranana Bishua Secha, we should sing in your salvation. Uvashem Elokeinu Nidgo, and we should raise our banner in the name of Hashem, Yemole Hashem, Umipaz Rav, and that Hashem should fulfill even gold in abundance, Umisuki Midavash Benoifet Sufim, and sweeter than honey and drippings from the combs. Gosh, what does that mean? And I completely can't find the right page here. Okay, try this again. I have three pages of the same thing, so you find the right place. Okay. Let's try that pasuk again. Oh, that didn't make any sense. All right. Gosh. What are we reading here? Hold on. It wasn't like that way this morning. I know. Did someone sneak in and change my tale?
Not that good, but I was like, wait a minute.
Hold on.
Yeah, I lost with
the... I was reading, like, what? I'm thinking, what am I reading? Okay. Well, now let's read the pasuk as it was this morning. Nirana b'shua sach, let me sing for joy at your salvation, uv'shem elokein and eagle, in the name of Hashem raise our banner, yimale Hashem kol mishalosecha, and may Hashem fulfill all of your requests. Now, it says, may we sing for joy at salvation from you. Right? You're singing out. Why are you singing out? Happy war to us! I mean, does that, you know, what, Niranana, we're singing for joy in the salvation of war?
That's in the aha, you know, at the checkpoint. Yeah.
So, what it means is that, you know, when a person has to ask another person for help, it looks like weakness. Why do I, the leader of the army, have to ask the other army for help? Well, I can't quite do it myself. Right, so you'll help me, and together we'll work out. It's a sign of weakness. Mm-hmm. And even if it's not really a sign of weakness for whatever reason, it looks like a sign of weakness, mm-hmm. especially in a military situation. But when you ask for a shelf from Hashem, it doesn't look like a sign of weakness. You were smart enough and brave enough and courageous enough and a tzaddik enough to be able to get Hashem to help you in your war. So Niranana b'shua secha, we're going to sing out about the salvation. And v'shem Elokein Anigol, we're going to raise the banner of Hashem so that the other nations can see the might of Hashem. We're going to raise up the banner. Well, we already know who was with us. Right? It's not like we need to say, oh, okay, let's see, it was, what? Hashem! Oh, right, Hashem! All right? But we want everybody else to see, you know why, who did this? You know why you were conquered? It's the name of Hashem. Now, raising up the banner, Anigol, if you remember your Humish, each tribe, each Shavit had their own banner. And in fact, those of you who ever had children in sixth grade have probably had to put out these little charts where all the banners were of the Shvatim. However, he's saying, we're going to raise we're going to raise our banner. So the Medrash says it's referring to the future when all the Shvatim will be united under one banner. V'shem Elokeinu Nidgol. And in the name of Hashem, that all can see, will raise our united banner, is David's tefillah. And that Hashem will grant all of our requests. In Pasuk Zayin, he says, Ata yedati ki yoshi Hashem Mashicho. Now I know that Hashem has saved His anointed one. Yanehu mishmei kodshu. And He will answer him from His holy place above. Bigvuros yesha yamino, with the omnipotent victories of His right arm. Now David is talking about, most likely he's talking about himself. That he's the anointed one. He's the anointed one as king. And Hashem will help him because Hashem gave me the kingship, so Hashem will help make sure that it's successful. Eilav orechas ve'eilav asusim, some with chariots, with horses. Right? V'anachnu b'shem Hashem elokeinu nazkir. So the enemies, they have their own plans. You know what their plans are? They got chariots, they got horses. They're going to take three chariots to the left and circle around six horses to the right. And then they're going to come in from the left, and then they're going to blow the thing that makes it sound like there's a lot of people, and then poof, they're going to send in the airplane. It's some with Susim Vanachnu. Simple, says David. B'shem Hashem Elokeinu Nazkir. We'll just call out the name of our God Hashem. Hema Karu V'naf Falu. They drop to their knees and fall. V'nachnu Kamna V'nis Odad. But we arose and were strengthened. Oh, invigorated, you said. Okay, I like that word. Invigorated. We weren't strengthened, I would probably were invigorated. Hashem Oshia Amelech Yaneinu V'yoin Koreinu. A famous pasuk. We'll see many times that Pesukim from Davening, other famous places, are often culled from various places in Tehillim. Hashem Oshia, Hashem save, HaMelech Ya'aneinu V'yom Koreinu, the king will answer us on the day that we call. Alright, that's David's tefillah for the people that were going out to war. And the tefillah fits very well, I think, with the description that we were discussing of how war is prosecuted under the Torah. Right? They may use their chariots, and we use Hashem's plan. Hashem gave us a much better plan. Right? So it doesn't mean literally that we just call out Hashem and we don't pick up our swords, and we just wait for them to magically poof away. But it means we use Hashem's plan. They come up with their own plans of chariots and horses. But we have an even better idea. We use Hashem's plan. The Hashem's plan is guaranteed to work. There's an interesting, I don't think we'll start Chaf Aleph today, but there's an interesting story. Should I put this mic here? There's a book written by Rabbi Yitzchak Rubin. He's a Rav of a shul in England, and he brings various stories that he tries to use to illustrate the points of the different kapitla. And he ties them to different things that happened to him in the shul, different people that he met in the shul. And he has a rather lengthy story here that he ties to the Holocaust He talks about a fellow that had become a Baal Tshuva and gotten married and had a whole cover of people and was a very successful young fellow in his yeshiva studies, and he was very successful in his in his social interaction. And it was a tremendous simcha. This fellow came to the chuppah to get married, and he said when he saw him, he really felt that he was looking at the greatness of the Jewish neshama. He says the secular world rips away a lot of our veneer and a lot of people, a lot of Jewish people who could be doing the right thing, but instead are tempted by various things in the secular world. But at the core, they still all have a Jewish neshama. Simple, but deep. And he brings an example that when he was a bacher in a camp in upstate New York, the counselors were sitting around schmoozing on Shabbos afternoon, drinking Coke and eating peanuts, your typical sort of young man, Shabbos afternoon counselor, you know, who had the hardest time with the kids, kind of schmoozing. And they started singing a niggun, and he said that there was no guarantee that anybody was on key or anything, but they were exuberant in their niggun. And the camp director passed by. Now, the camp director was a Holocaust survivor himself, and he couldn't stand to hear them destroy this beautiful niggun. The singing was definitely exuberant, but perhaps it left a little to be desired. Yeah, the exuberance was perhaps its only real attribute. And so he sat down and he taught them how to sing the song properly. Now the words of the song are dum diddy dum dum, dum diddy dum, ein zwei drei. That's the song. Dum diddy dum di, dum diddy dum di, one, two, three. Now, if you can imagine the boys singing this with their exuberance, and here comes the alter yid, the Holocaust survivor, is the camp director, and they're destroying this beautiful niggun. And the boys think the beautiful niggun is dum diddy dumpty, dum diddy dumpty, ein zwei drei. It's not exactly, you know, Taylor. Right. So the camp director sat down and he sang the song. And he sang it slowly, and then a little bit faster, a little bit faster, alright? Until all the boys were mamish crying from the beauty of this simple niggun. And if you know young men, getting them to be moved is not necessarily an easy thing, right? Said it was so simple, it's so bittersweet, right, that they couldn't believe what they were hearing. He says he still remembers that to the day, right? And that's what he was thinking of when he saw this young man getting married, all right? That it seems like, hey, they came out true, with Shuva, I, one, two, three. But beneath that is something so beautiful that it's hard to even express in words. And he says his kapitel tells us this in its own way. The kapitel says, may he remember all your offerings and sacrifices, we said. Right? So he's thinking about this camp director. And he says, a generation that gave more of itself than the one witnessing the Holocaust would be hard to find. Every family was touched, every family had its sacrifices. Yet from such a broken-hearted people, we've seen the building of an entire new world that can turn away the secular glimmer of gold and seek out Hashem. Hashem has remembered our offerings and given us nachas beyond expectations. And he says he was thinking about the next pasuk, may he fulfill your desires and bring your plans to fruition. This our gedolim gave us hope, and what did our plans revolve around? Tyre. Look today at the yeshivos and the seminaries grown in 50 years beyond all expectations. Could you find someone that in 1950 would have agreed and predicted the yeshivos and seminaries and the success that we see today? We tend to get caught up in, oh, they need more money and it's another dinner and what are we going to do? Look around and see what's happened, he say, and see that it's not I, that it's a beautiful Ein Zwei Drei. Says, we'll sing joyously over the victory you send and raise our banners in the name of Hashem. And our banners, I was thinking, are the next generation. We try and raise them with humility and the knowledge is Hashem's way of delivering us from the grasp of the cruel world that surrounds us. And on the Pasuk, some rely on chariots, some on horses, but we'll use the name of Hashem. So he was thinking about this constantly. You know, there are those who say that the only way we can survive is to embrace the trappings of the society around us. They see loyalty to Hashem as ludicrous. In answer, we show them the fruits of such loyalty. You rely on your chariots and horses. We evoke the name of Hashem in our children and see our young people and see them under the chuppah and see what we've accomplished. They have bowed down and fallen, the Pasuk says, we've risen and stood firm. He says, you know, he's thinking, those who worship the falseness of the materialistic world have been crushed under the weight of their goals. They never get anywhere. They never feel like they're making progress. But people who have seen the truth of Hashem's love can stand firm despite the ridicule of others. And finally, the last passage says, Hashem save us. Hashem will answer us on the day that we cry to Him. And you know what he was thinking as he watched this Jungaban's chasana? Our challenges are not over. There's still many problems and people who need support and care. But we have the right address. Hashem will answer us when we call from the depths of our heart. So he said, that niggun that plays in my mind, the beauty of that niggun tells me how what looks simple really has a tremendous tiefkeit, a tremendous deepness to it. He said that he went to the Sheva Brachas then for the young couple, and the guy's Chavra from Yeshiva was at the Sheva Brachas. There was a guy learning in Kyle in London. There was a physician who took off his practice to learn a year in Eretz Yisrael. The host of the evening taught in a local seminary. So he said he's going to come with the Devar Torah. He was going to come with the Devar Torah. And instead he thought he'd teach them a niggun. A simple one, with no real words or anything, but it showed the depths of the Jewish people that David HaMelech is representing in this kapitel. And of course the niggun he taught them was Tam Diridam Din, Tam Tiriramtam, Ein Zwei Drei. So this kapitel that David HaMelech wrote on behalf of the success of Yoav and the army really sums up a tremendous amount of Yesodis and points in Yiddishkeit. We should all be zeicha to see the meaning here and to be able to increase our own avodas Hashem. Mm-hmm. Okay. Questions? Mm-hmm.